I am a registrar at St. Olaf College, and I also teach religion. The two of them don't always fit together very nicely because, on the one hand, you're trying to, you know how it is, Tom, trying to turn your grades in on time and so on. And on the other hand, it's fun to feel released in the classroom to do creative things. So we're going to discuss two or three texts from Luke's Gospel this week. We're also going to discuss, for sure, two texts that are from the Acts of the Apostles, which is also a book that Luke, the evangelist, wrote. The topic today, Larry Rasmussen likes catchy titles, so you look in the text and find something that looks catchy. So, optical fixation, of course, you would recognize comes from verse 20, where after Jesus sits down, the expression is here that the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. So, kind of like Lambo zeroing in on him after he has sat down from this reading. So that's the great idea behind the title. Okay, this book is in the bookstore. I think there are only 5 copies left now. At least that's what I checked on Saturday. It's by Danker, and it's in a commentary series. This is called MOOC. And this is somewhat helpful, especially for getting an idea about the themes that Luke uses as an overview for the book. It is not a blow-by-blow commentary. This book is not in the library it's not in the bookstore. It's called Jesus in the New Age. This is by the same author, Danker, but this is a section-by-section, verse-by-verse account. But this is the one that I ordered. It's $2.95 if you care to pick one up. End of commercial. Okay, now, the particular passage we're going to discuss today is Luke 4, verses 16 to 30. Now, if you look at the gospel as a whole, there are literary sections, and the first section, usually isolated by people who try to divide the gospel into parts, is called a Jerusalem Judea section. That is more of a southern Palestine section. The activity is Bethlehem, the birth stories, John the Baptist, things like this. And so the first section of Luke's Gospel, you might say, goes up to chapter 4, verse 13. That's through the passage about Jesus being tempted by the devil. The second section of the Gospel therefore starts at chapter 4, verse 14, and goes all the way through chapter 9, verse 50. And the reason this is set up is, again, kind of a geographical rationale, namely that the activity of Jesus between 4:14 and through 9:50 is primarily in and around Galilee. We'll see after that. He is much more mobile. Starting at 9:51, for 10 chapters, he's journeying toward Jerusalem, but shifting around more so than in this section, where it's primarily in and around Galilee. Tends to be in northern Palestine. So this passage that we're going to discuss, therefore, is the first one in this section in Galilee. It starts with verse 16 of chapter 4. Okay, I'm going to read this, and please follow along. Do you all have Bibles? There's some here if you don't. Or look on to the neighbor or whatever. Chapter 4, starting in verse 16. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And he went to the synagogue, as his custom was, on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read. And there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, quote, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord," unquote. And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here also in your own country.'" And he said, "Truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his own country. But in truth I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when there came a great famine over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath, in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." Well, when they heard this, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and put him out of the city, and led him to the brow of the hill on which their city was built, that they might throw him down headlong. But passing through the midst of them, he went away. So he slips out. Precarious situation. Okay, now, we're going to solve some problems together today. Here are some of them. Is it better back here?
Yeah.
Is that pretty good?
Yeah.
Everyone see?
Yeah.
Okay. The other day when I was standing up quite a bit, I would talk to them, I kept having them like this. I should have a mesh or something. You can see each other. Okay, these are some of the problems we're going to discuss to try to get at the theme or themes in this particular text. Does Jesus try to identify himself as a prophet? He is quoting from Isaiah here. And is that part of his game plan here in doing so? Secondly, does this quote from Isaiah mean that Jesus perceives his mission primarily to be to the down-and-outers, the have-nots of society? Is that how he perceives his mission? He read from this particular spot in Isaiah. Is the disappearance in verse 30, we see he just passed through the midst of them, is that different from other disappearances? What kind of other disappearances are there? See a magician performing acts, a Houdini or something? Number four, is the reference to Capernaum in verse 23 a reminiscence about previous events? More about that later. So this is the approach we want to use this morning, is looking at some of these problems and trying to work through them together. Now, I'll provide some basic background to this text and some specifics about the text before we come back again to these questions. So just let them kind of sit and sift a little bit in your minds. First of all, the quotation here used in verses 18 and 19 is from Isaiah. Now, the quotation is actually a combination of at least a couple of places in Isaiah, that is chapter 61 and chapter 58. So it's a mosaic, in a sense, from Isaiah. And for you who read and studied Isaiah, there's consensus that the first 39 chapters are from an earlier time than the last chapters, and there's also a feeling that the last 10 chapters in Isaiah might be later than the 15 chapters that precede that. So the time that Isaiah was writing was somewhere between 539 BC and 510 BC that this was written. Now the circumstance is that the southern kingdom, or the Judeans, had been in captivity in Babylonia, and in 539 BC Cyrus, the king of Persia, came and took hold of Babylonia, and therefore provided for the possibility of the Jews, the Palestinians, you might say, to go back from Babylonia to their own land of Judea. And so this period in history was a very, viewed as a kind of another exodus almost, not quite that significant theologically, but it was a time when they could return to their homeland. And so we see here that there is a theme of hope, of return, of another theme that is in the latter part of Isaiah, that is a new creation. They have a new lease on life. Creation will almost take place again in their experience. So this is from whence this particular passage comes. Now, what is the audience? To whom is this, who's in the audience as this story is being told? I mentioned that this second section in Luke, the Galilean section, starts with verse 14 in this chapter. It goes for five chapters. Is it clear who is in the audience? Okay, it's kind of a homecoming. The Nazarenes are there. How about the kind of response toward the end of the passage, the negative response? Would that suggest that there are others in the audience too? Well, they're very possibly all from Nazareth, but some are maybe the common folk, good Jews, and the others might be some of the religious leaders, you know, among the common folk too. It's interesting that, I mean, Jesus has in a sense just come out of the wilderness and comes to Nazareth, his hometown, and depending on how you interpret what Jesus has to say about Elijah and Elisha, it does seem like he's being very critical of these prophets. And he's really going out after these prophets who were very sacred in many ways to good Jews. He's really going after them in a very early stage in his ministry here, which is not always what you find in the other Gospels. But he's really going after them. Now there are two other accounts in the Gospels, two parallel accounts to this particular passage. And I think we should turn to them briefly. You can keep your hand in your Bible at Luke 4, but let's turn first to Mark's version, which is in chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. Darius, do you have that? Would you read Mark 6, 1 to 6?
He went away from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get all this? What is the wisdom given to him? What mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him, and Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his own country and among his own kin and in his own house. And he could not do no mighty works there except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. and he marveled because of their unbelief. And he went about among the villages.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Let's not comment on that, but turn immediately to the other one. That's in Matthew 13, verses 53 to 58. Okay, of these three versions, which two are the most alike?
Mark and Matthew.
Right, Mark and Matthew. Now, assuming that Mark was the earliest version, and that both Matthew and Luke used Mark, obviously Matthew is just reiterating Mark more so than Luke is. So the question immediately arises, did Luke have access to some other materials? I mean, neither of Matthew and Mark quotes Isaiah, for example, right? That text, which is a fairly big chunk of what Luke does. Neither Matthew nor Mark refers to Elijah or Elisha, either, by name, right? So there's some real differences. And therefore, one thing to ask when you do Bible study is, when we come to the question of themes that Luke's passage suggests to us, are those themes ones that are found elsewhere in his book? That is, are they themes common to what he is trying to get at by even going about the process of writing the gospel? If there's this much difference between his and two other versions, for example, is there a conscious effort here to go after something else? Well, we're not going to go into detail with Mark or Matthew because we just don't have time, but it's just a question to keep in your mind, maybe for your own further study. You'll notice in Mark's account, it's clear that the disciples are part of the audience. He's in Nazareth in all three cases, right? His hometown, boy. And is there anything else that strikes you about Mark and Matthew's accounts?
Right, yeah.
No, Luke ends on a very kind of a confrontive note. Something's going to happen, and he gets away fast. Right.
Maybe the Luke has a different purpose in mind, or point in mind to make them than the other two.
So possibly faith or lack thereof is a factor or a theme in Mark and Matthew's, but possibly missing in Luke's.
In Luke's difference, they seem to want something. Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did in Capernaum, do here also in our country, in your country. I don't see that in the other two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They want him to do something for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One other word that pops out to me in Mark and Matthew's accounts is the word offense. Or in some of your versions, it might be stumbling block. You see that? It's a common phrase that we often use in our theology, the cross as a stumbling block. By the way, I'm just pointing out some literary differences here, but okay? Now, let me, from this other one of Danker's, which is, like I mentioned, more of a verse by verse, let me just show you the setting that he points out here. For Jesus reading this text from Isaiah. Danker says, ordinarily the president of the synagogue would invite another Israelite to read from the scriptures. But in Luke's narrative, Jesus appears to make the move independently. His opening of the book was literally the unrolling of a scroll. You've all seen that. Whether the passage chosen by the Lord was a fixed lesson for the day cannot be determined. Nor can the exact words read on the occasion be recovered, for Luke's rendering of the text from Isaiah is a composite of Isaiah 61, verse 1, 58, verse 2, and 61, verse 2. So, we don't know whether this was the lesson for the day, the Perksby series that was being followed for this Sabbath or not, or whether Jesus pulled together some things in order to go a direction that he wanted to do. All right, now, in verse 21, we read, "Today the scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Now, I want to point out that in chapter 24 of Luke, which is the last chapter of his gospel, there's something that sounds fairly similar to this statement in verse 21. In chapter 24, verse 44, this is Jesus speaking, we read, "Then he said to them, 'These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled.'" Now, there are a number of times in Luke's gospel where this feeling of continuity comes up. That is, he tells his disciples, "Do you not remember when I did this or when I said this to you?" He tries to kind of build them up for the ministry that they're going to have to go out with. But he keeps referring to things that he has done in the past. "And while I was with you, you see, I was speaking, there were words, there were deeds, and did I not keep telling you that things were being fulfilled in your presence, just as I did here in chapter 4. Okay, another detail is in verse 24, the word "truly." This word is used by Luke commonly as a kind of a formula to introduce a prophetic statement. You who were here last week remember the phrase "and I say to you" coming up as something not introducing a prophecy, but rather introducing possibly a change of audience. You know, talking here, "and I say to you." But "truly" is a key word that tips you off that a prophecy might be coming up. Okay, now, let's move back to these questions on the board, okay? This passage from Luke is quite different from Matthew and Mark's. Now, do you think Jesus is trying consciously to identify himself as a prophet by quoting from a prophet very dear to the Jewish heritage? It's more conscious of fulfilling a prophecy than being a prophet. Okay, in other words, are you saying that he's aware of what the prophets have prophesied, and he's showing how in himself he is the fulfillment of a particular prophecy?
On the other hand, he says, "I, a prophet, am not going to be accepted here because I'm in my native town." So he does seem to identify with the prophet role there, doesn't he? Almost I feel indignant that they can't understand him once again. So I feel he does intend to take the prophet role, particularly as he goes up, takes the book, unrolls it, all very definite, says this, hands the book back, as if preparing what he's going to say.
Now you notice in Matthew and Mark that the word prophet and so on is not used. The emphasis on who Jesus is more in terms of lineage, right? Related to, you know, brothers and sisters and things like this. Relatives is quite specific, but Luke is not that specific about that tie-in to Nazareth. It's interesting, you look at other places in the Gospel and see how Jesus refers to himself, or even in circumstances where he is related to God, how God refers to Jesus. For example, in chapter 9, verse 35, which is part of the transfiguration scene, the voice comes out of the cloud to those who are there with Jesus, and the voice says, "This is my son, my chosen, listen to him." Where God supposedly is speaking, he is identifying Jesus, maybe not as a Latter-day prophet, just one example, but more in terms of sonship, in relation to God. This is a debatable question. As you know, in Isaiah, the theme of the suffering servant just pops out all over the place. And this question comes up then in the New Testament. If Jesus is the fulfillment of Old Testament scripture and especially prophecy, is Jesus the suffering servant who is fulfilling God's plan for his life by going the hard road all the way to the cross? You know, to what extent is he a suffering Jesus in Luke's gospel going the way of the cross? And the extent to which you feel that he is or is not a suffering figure, a servant figure in the gospel, would influence your answer to this question. Because, as I pointed out in Luke, often Jesus is viewed as, well, his two favorite words are Christ and Lord. Servant or prophet, or words like that are not as common as other words. Son of God or son of man is also quite a common term or title for Jesus. Also, you have to look at the whole flow of the gospel to see the extent to which Jesus is suffering along the way. You could say he's suffering already at the end of this passage, right? He's confronted with a difficult situation. How is he going to handle it? So, even though he quotes from Isaiah and he uses the Old Testament a fair amount, Matthew, for example, uses the Old Testament more so than do Mark or Luke. And so in a way, one looks at passages in Matthew as bringing up prophetic themes like suffering servant and so on. You tend to think that that would be more prevalent in passages in Matthew than in Luke. And so here, being God's son, being a Jesus who is true to his heritage, I mean, here he's in Nazareth. Like you said, I mean, this is his hometown, this is where he grew up. He was a good Jewish boy, learned things very well. When he was 12 years old, he was astounding people already with his knowledge. And now he comes back, and he wants to show them that he's not just throwing off his heritage and what the town folk expect of him. But he does have something else he's getting at, too. Let's go to 3 next. How about this disappearance in verse 30? Are there any other places you can think of where Jesus does a disappearing act? This is not real significant in the theme. But you get the idea that Jesus is kind of a Houdini who can show up or disappear at will. I mean, do you think this is just an expression of Jesus for the fact that there was a conflict here? Maybe it was pushing and shoving, there was a crowd. You know, some people wanting to get at Jesus, others kind of saying, no, he's our hometown boy, and that he just kind of can slip through the crowd that's getting riled up. Are there any other disappearances you can think of, Bill?
The only one other one I could think of would be the ascension, if you want to call that a disappearing act. Okay. Depends how you want to look at that. Also, whether that's a disappearing act.
Okay, that's one of them I had in mind.
Okay. People stood there and watched him go, so it wasn't kind of, I mean, this is stupid in that
disappeared or that he just slipped through the crowd, but maybe they became caught up in the debates back and forth about the issue and he was able to just slip out?
Well, another one is in 24, verse 31. This is after Jesus has risen from the dead. And it's been the road to Emmaus, you see, has been the immediately preceding story here. And in 24, verse 31, it says, "And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished out of their sight." As soon as they recognize him, he vanishes. Then, of course, in 51, as Bill mentioned, verse 51, that while he blessed them, he parted from them. Well, these three examples of kind of fading off discreetly or disappearing seem to be very different because all three of them use different Greek verbs, for example. And so each situation has to be taken by itself. Luke does not seem to have a theme of a magician here or anything like that. And so in this text, you have to take the circumstance of the kind of conflict and the difficult situation that's being presented here and assume that it may be much more of a human sort of thing. With it's not like the president where all the Secret Service men will make a funnel for him. Like Fritz Mondale was at St. Olaf when Sidney Rand was inaugurated as ambassador to Norway, and the students did a good job of getting together a rally. Of course, most of them were from outsiders, you know, like Carleton College students. But the Secret Service men made a real tunnel, a real phalanx, so that Mondale could safely go from one building to another. But that's the circumstance. Well, let's go back here to number two now. Those are the quotes from Isaiah. Why do you think there's a quote here from Isaiah? Does that mean that Jesus himself, in the presence of the synagogue, his Jewish leaders, and so on, in his hometown, is announcing his game plan for the future? Do you think that by picking this mosaic of texts from Isaiah, that Jesus is consciously saying that to those who have been oppressed, down and out, to those people, my mission is primarily directed?
I wonder, John, if it's a statement of what it means to be Messiah. In another setting, Jesus is asked if he is the Messiah, and he doesn't say yes or no. He says, "Go and tell them what you see and hear." And then it says, "I preach good news to the poor. Blind are healed, the lame walk." These kinds of things are the answer he gives to the question, "Are you Messiah?" So I guess I've understood this as Luke's way of passing along Jesus' self-understanding, his messianic consciousness, rather than a question of which audience or you know, does he identify as a prophet, rather a kind of the meaning of his ministry as Messiah. And this is announced then in his hometown.
Kind of an inaugural sermon.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And correct me if I'm wrong, is the Isaiah, let's see, is that in exile then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in fact, the people are poor, and they are the oppressed. This is their setting, and their hope rests in a Messiah who would come and to release them. So that then reinforces. It is to Don and others, but it's to the people who are that as the people of God in Babylon.
Yeah, the people in Babylon, the concept of the remnant is a very strong one in the Old Testament. That is, not every last man, woman, and child went to Babylon, but it's viewed as the remnant in captivity in Babylon, and that not until this remnant is restored and brought back to the homeland can the nation feel one again. And so therefore, it's not everybody, but it's a very important remnant, maybe a righteous remnant, and is this, does Jesus say that those who, that his messiahship will be defined in terms of those who have had less of a heritage or less opportunity than others? I mean, we read in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, for example, you have the that's in chapter 16, you have the contrast of the rich man who goes to Hades when he dies, and Lazarus who goes to Abraham's bosom or heaven. And one of the points made there is that the rich man not only was rich materially, but he, as a good Jew, maybe a Pharisee here, had the heritage of the Old Testament. He had the law and the prophets. And that somehow those were not enough for him as a basis to understand who this Messiah was. The Lazarus, though, a Gentile, a non-Jew, on the other hand, did not have this heritage, and yet was the one who believed that this Messiah is really the long-awaited one. He did not have that heritage. Now, the down and outers of society often are portrayed in Luke's Gospel as Gentiles, those who have, they're sometimes Jews also, but also Gentiles. Some of them have the Old Testament heritage, some do not have that heritage. And is Jesus' mission here to those who simply have not had an opportunity to have the scriptures, for example, as a heritage?
Is it that, or is it the tradition that comes out of the exile, namely that the poor ones of Yahweh, the Anawim, are those who will recognize the Messiah? Because those who are poor understand their dependence upon God and the need, their need for God to address their condition, to liberate them. I mean, the movement around Jesus is clearly a poor people's movement. And then the question is it because Jesus is addressing it to the poor, or is it because the poor are thronged to him because they recognize in him the signs of Messiah that they've been nurtured on since the exile? And the rich may have the law and the prophets, but they no longer need God. They don't need this messianic liberator. They don't feel that need. They don't understand that need.
Well, in support of what you're saying, Mary, is the fact that the poor here really means God helps.
Yeah.
The ones whom God helps is what the poor really means here, in the sense of definitions and so on. Just like Lazarus, the only time in a parable that the proper name is used for one of the characters, the word Lazarus means helpless one, or God helps. So yes, it is to those that recognize that God can be the source of help for them that Jesus seems to be directing his ministry here.
This, in the Winter Community, we study John Howard Yoder's and all types of Jesus, and he makes a real strong case that Jesus here is proclaiming a new year of Jubilee, in which was the time when all debts would be canceled, all land would be returned. And he shows how in this passage there's Jubilee language. All the prisoners would be freed, slaves would be freed. Jesus, this is why Jesus was so threatening, that he was proclaiming that the Jubilee that was announced in the Old Testament was to happen, what, every 50 years? Mm-hmm. Had more or less been set aside because it was not convenient.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, in your studies, if that's, is that a normal interpretation of this passage?
Yes, the acceptable year of the Lord, yeah, the year of Jubilee, right, all debts canceled, and prisoners released. I think that can be the setting for this particular circumstance.
My difficulty with that is that if, and that's a rather extensive sort of, that has tremendous implications, the year of Jubilee, especially for the dominant elders. And if this is, if the dominant elders is such a prevalent theme in this, you would tend to think that there might be a little more reference later on to this particular year, if it's, you know, in such a unique thing in history. This would be the only time, of course, during Jesus' ministry that that year would have appeared. But that's not to say it couldn't be, because there are a lot of other very significant themes, like even the destruction of Jerusalem, that it's hard to decide from my gospel whether he wrote just before Jerusalem was destroyed or just afterwards. You know, really important historical thing. I think so. Losing and those who are lost and those who are found are a very common contrast. Those who are rich, those who are poor, those who have a sister, that's Old Testament, those who do not. A lot of these kind of contrasts. Sons of life, sons of his world, another contrast. Okay, so if we could summarize that, we do feel, and you feel otherwise, that in a way this is an inaugural sermon, telling the hometown folks that Jesus' mission will not only be to those who most need God, but also it will be very probably in line with God's own plan for his people. That Jesus and God are together, that Jesus' loyalty is to God, and that he has a sense of the divine purpose that he feels compelled to minister to in his brief time on earth. Now, it's interesting here that, you know, you compare Mark's gospel, where you constantly have this idea of Jesus being very secretive or almost embarrassed by the possibility that he is the Messiah. He performs miracles and then tells the people who have seen him perform a miracle, don't go out and tell anybody about this. You know, keep it under wraps. I don't want people to know too much yet. And this is what you keep having in Mark's gospel. But in Luke, especially if this is really an unfolding of what his game plan is going to be, at the very beginning of his ministry in Galilee, the intent is quite different. Okay, how about question number four? But is the reference to Capernaum in verse 23 a reminiscence about previous events? At first, it will strike you in terms of my response to it, a kind of technical, maybe tricky question. But there's a larger theme that this is supposed to be used to. Verse 23, reference to concern. Is that a reminiscence of our previous events now? Do you think? Here is in Nazareth. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here also. Now in Nazareth. Well, obviously to answer the question, you have to check to see what, where he's been and so on, right? And I wouldn't be asking the question if it were obvious that he came directly from Capernaum to Nazareth. So I'll give you this one. We have not, there's nothing obvious to say that he has been in Capernaum prior to this time in Luke's Gospel. No reference to Capernaum up to this point. And some interpreters, I won't drop names because I know that's confusing, but feel that Luke, for example, is a Gentile Christian who's writing this gospel someplace outside of Palestine, and among other things, they do not feel that Luke is that well versed in the geography of Palestine. And then they point to something like this to say, see, he's kind of confused as to the path that Jesus is going because he doesn't know the, you know, where everything lies exactly. In Mark, for example, we notice that the parallel passages in chapter 6, verses 1 to 6, if you look previous to that, I mean, all three gospels have this being in Nazareth, right? But in Mark's gospel, it's very clear that in chapter 2, verse 1, that Jesus has been in Capernaum. And in Matthew's gospel, where the parallel account does not occur until chapter 13, there has been plenty of activity going on in Capernaum prior to this. Now, in verse 14, just prior to where the passage starts, it says, and Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee. Now, where are Capernaum and Nazareth? Geographical. Well, they are both in Galilee. Capernaum is on the Sea of Galilee. Nazareth is southwest of that, but they are both in Galilee. You see? So, and all this, these next five, six chapters are all taking place in and around Galilee. And so, it seems like an academic point whether Jesus has been in Capernaum prior to this and done some acts. Maybe he was, and Luke just chose not to record some of them because of the other points he wanted to get to. But immediately following this text, we see in verse 31, and he went down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee. So, then all of a sudden he goes to Capernaum. Now, the reason that some people try to make much of this seeming conflict of locale, of places, is this. Luke is writing this gospel about 50 years after Jesus has died, probably in the 80s or so. And it's becoming more and more clear to Luke that some of the things that Jesus was saying, some of the things that Jesus' hearers were expecting are not going to transpire. That is, remember when Jesus said, some of you right here in this generation will not die before you see the kingdom come. Well, during these 50 years, some of those people who were in that generation of Jesus' time have died, and the kingdom has not come yet. The years are passing on and on. What's going to happen? When is Jesus coming back again? And so, one possibility is that Luke is writing his gospel from the angle that he's recognizing that there's this time between Jesus' death and Jesus' second coming, or the parousia of his coming again, is going to be much longer than any of those Jesus Paul who wrote 15, 20 years after Jesus died. Would have guessed. So therefore, Luke himself believes some kind of a theology of this in between time. Then he writes the gospel with this in mind, and that maybe 5 years later, when he gets to the point of writing the Acts, and he says to himself, we've got all these small churches now, and we need an ecclesiology, we need a doctrine of the church because this time might be a very volatile time. And so bringing this back on the Capernaum Nazareth business, some would say that Nazareth represents his hometown, it kind of represents the past, what has been fulfilled by Jesus, by his coming. The Messiah has come. The times of the future are now a present reality because Jesus is here. John the Baptist belongs to the previous epoch. He's kind of the latter day Elijah. Salvation is a possibility now that the Messiah has come. The Messiah came out of Nazareth. He's announcing his game plan here from Nazareth. But Capernaum is more of a mixed town. There's a Roman garrison there, for example, and there are many more Gentiles there. And that the future ministry of Jesus might be to more Capernaum around Palestine, to more of those who have not had the strict Jewish heritage that may or may not recognize the Messiah. But this is a theme that the of hope. This is Isaiah stresses the new creation, the people coming back from exile, the righteous remnant from Babylon to Judah. So also moved by seemingly having even an antithesis between Nazareth and Capernaum might be pointing toward the further mission of Jesus away from his hometown to Capernaum, which is on the kind of the edges of Galilee, but then even beyond that, outside of Galilee, as pointing toward the kingdom of God, which is here, but is yet to be realized also. Now, does all that make any sense?
He was in Capernaum first, though, according to Luke.
He was what?
He was in Capernaum first, then came back to Nazareth, and then went to Capernaum afterwards.
Well, don't say he was in Capernaum first, before this particular passage, does it?
For what we heard you did at Capernaum, do here also in your own country.
Yeah. It implies that he may have been there. Others look at the word in verse 23. You will quote. Adventure says this, for example. That is a reference to the things I'm going to do in Capernaum, which starts in verse 31. It's very hard to ferret this out. All I'm trying to point to is the fact that this geographical difficulty as to whether he really was in Capernaum before he came to Nazareth, whether he really did some mighty works there, is used as a basis for some interpreters to think that Luke really has a theological point to make by the difference between the hometown and another geographical locale.
So it couldn't be what I would call the obvious of him having some success in Capernaum, feeling good about that, and then trying to go back to his hometown where he can extend it and find out that he was shocked and couldn't get his point across, and therefore almost as well, if they don't want me, I can go back into Capernaum to continue my mission there.
Yeah, he just, obviously, if he has a reputation already built up through obvious other encounters, one would be less critical of him if he were to say what he did about Elijah and Elisha. And he's really just, but in Luke's gospel, you see, he's really jumping out very fast against a very sacred heritage. where we readers don't get the feeling that he really has established himself, his credentials. Of course, this is Jesus' method, of course, shock therapy. And also Luke. I mean, Mark is very good, even though he keeps holding Jesus' messiahship in a shroud, trying to have Jesus cover up the fact that he really is the Messiah. And the question whether Jesus really understood himself to be the Messiah, we don't really engage. That's always the question.
Verse 14, when Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and a report concerning him went out through all the surrounding country, tells me that he had a reputation upon entering his hometown, and that was already, you know that there was already rumors spreading who his person was. And this is where he had to clarify really what his purpose was, and that's where question two is down and out is one of the focuses.
Yeah. And I would insert the word third in verse 22. The day that there is, I would even confess the gospel, at least in his hometown, there's a lot of stories about him, whether pastor or not, he had many of these things.
Yeah,
it's even the parallels that the way Mark and Matthew have it, that indeed a lot of, he did have quite a reputation, a lot of other things. By his church. So then we come to the point, why is Luke placed it at this point in his gospel? As Larry suggested, perhaps it's to show what kind of a Messiah he is. Perhaps to show also that he is announcing his plan for his ministry. You don't forget to send his inaugural sermon coming out this Sunday in the gospel. Right after the temptation of the wilderness, this comes. And so he's announcing the plan, who he is, and then also the question of to whom is his ministry directed? Because I think the answer to this question is another theme of the gospel. To whom is his ministry directed?
Don't you think the placing of this after the wilderness temptation is just in full support of the point of view that this is a statement from his own self-understanding? Because what is clarified in the wilderness encounter with thinking is who he is and what his power is. I mean, that is the time when Jesus wrestles with his own mission, his own self-understanding, and then this is the announcement. This is the public announcement of what has transpired in the wilderness. And there were such rumors going around how he was kind of who he was all about and stuff, but he wanted to set the record straight. And was, maybe the idea of holding in the form of rumor control. So this is what I'm about. All this other stuff I don't know, but this is one thing I know I'm about. They weren't excluded, but their conditions of joining were by giving in the goods to the community and then that passed around as needed.
For the most part, there are a couple spots in Luke where Luke kind of changes things a little bit, where he telling his disciples, you don't only have to take vows of poverty and chastity if you're going to follow me, because the people to whom you will minister will be the artisans and the bankers and the others, and you have to be aware of their shrewdness. You have to be aware of how their value system is defined and how wealth and so on influences their attitude toward other things. And so, yes, in a personal way, you have to give up everything to be my disciple, but you can't do that quite all the way, at least you disciples can't, because you've got to talk the same language as some of these other people that you're going to be involving yourselves with. And the true riches, of course, will be spiritual riches, but it's not a pure asceticism here, or purely to the down and outers that he's directing his entire ministry.
I think there's a danger in that, there could be a danger in spiritualizing these, you know. If I think Isaiah has this charge, he lives very specifically to a redistribution of wealth, you know, even a large prayer for getting his death. And what, you know, I'm always a little uncomfortable with, you know, lost faith, and, you know, I don't know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think we have a tendency to be a little afraid.
Very familiar with that. It's just the people who tend to bear that in mind, too.
You know, but somehow Jesus here was dealing very specifically with economics. You know, when people were living economically.
Yeah, the poor can be viewed as those who recognize as God, that they need God's help. The down and outers are those who recognize that they're in need of help. What Luke says elsewhere, he, you know, those who humble themselves will be exalted, all this kind of, all these themes, is that the attitude toward God is what makes the difference. Those who are rich are those who have the right attitude toward God. Those who are poor are really the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man is really the poor one in the end, because of his attitude, his relationship to God.
But there is a question, though, then, whether, having said that, and making the judgments on the basis of attitude, there are any consequences for the rest of one's life. I mean, is a rich person, economically rich person, who understands that he or she is dependent upon God, does that person continue to be economically well off, having recognized that? Or is there some drastic change in their own way of life that puts them in a different place? I think there's just all sorts of evidence that there is that kind of change. So there are political, economic, social consequences of the discovery. And so much of the interpretation of so many of these passages have been ways of letting rich people say, we are poor if we don't understand that we're spiritually impoverished if we don't understand we depend upon God. Now we do depend upon God, and then just go on. Mm-hmm. Without any noticeable difference whatsoever, except the declaration of a difference of attitude or some arena between the self and God that has no public consequence. If they go in that direction. And then the other thing to ask is whether there are changes as the church takes in increasing numbers of people who are economically well off. Whether that isn't to be noticed in the text. I mean, there are New Testament scholars that talk about certain changes that occur already in the Gospel of Mark as rich people join the church. And so, Fellow Gettysburg, who has done a lot of work on wealth and poverty in the New Testament, says that Jesus saying that the camel cannot go through the rich man, you can't can't get to heaven any more than the camel goes through a needle by. That's the original form. And then it's the editor that adds a little bit later, but with God all things are possible. And it just reflects the change of membership in the church, and this is some kind of accommodation. And if you isolate the earlier one, you have much more of a rich-poor conflict. And the rich aren't excluded, but they're coming to community on terms by which they give up their wealth. And so it may be attitudinal is the core of the matter, but it is not without concrete consequences for very specific realities, such as wealth and poverty.
This is why a parable like the steward, the unjust steward, is such a controversial one, because here the steward is charged by the master as not doing his job well enough, and that the master definitely is going to fire the steward. The steward quickly goes out to these renters and lets them reduce their debt by a chunk. And the steward's taking a risk here. The master ends up commending the steward for doing this, saying that using possessions, using material things as a way to build up friends in this world is a commendable thing. And if you ensure your future, even if I as master have not approved of this little very quick, the master does approve of what the steward did in reducing his renter's debt. The steward was taking a risk and could well have, the master could have gotten even much madder at him for doing it. But the master commends him saying, you use material things to help ensure your future. And the question is then, since this whole parable is directed to disciples, is does Jesus encourage dishonesty in order to get on to other kinds of to secure your future by having friends? I mean, use money, use wealth, however you need to make sure that personal relationships are solidified for the future. It's who you know that matters, you see, not what you have. Well, that's an ongoing question. I think we might get back to that some more at the end of this, maybe on Friday or Saturday. But one other thing that I want to just mention here, because this is really a sermon inaugurating his ministry, is that Jesus really does attack Elijah and Elisha, two very venerable prophets, saying that with as far as widows and lepers that these prophets helped, it was one widow and one leper, and both of them were kind of beyond the confines of our chosen people. They were out beyond, they're up Athens and Sidon and so on. And therefore he's indirectly or directly, depending on how you feel about it, saying that your prophets and your law and so on are perhaps not sufficient. Or if they're sufficient, then they should help you recognize that I really am the Messiah. And that therefore, if you, my hometown people, cannot recognize me as Messiah, you're going to try to, burn me out of here and just do that. Well, then, my ministry, my mission will be maybe directed primarily to the Gentiles. So, this can be a recognition early in the ministry that receptivity will primarily be by the Gentiles. Now, what's troubling about that as far as rich and poor and so on is that you often feel, is Christianity better received by the old, the less learned, the less rich, the less wise in the ways of the world, the less political, the ones who are not in power? Is Christianity more acceptable by those who are not as learned, who do not have this strong heritage and education of the Pharisees and the other Jews. So it's a question what, or they would mission work. The easier to convert souls to that's an old concept of mission work, that's what it is. The savages are out there without any viable religion, therefore Christianity or anything else has much easier going there than in the real crises, the real tough situations in life.